Good evening, I'm Jeff Horwich, and this is The Week from In the Loop. Glad to have you with us as we take a whack at the week's news. In fact, that sound gives me kind of an idea for a theme for the week. Kicking them when they're down. Think about it. New Orleans, just what they need. They get an oil spill. John McCain, already trailing in most polls. Now he has to contend with Obama-rama on two continents. And for the rest of us, just when we saw our 401ks wriggling out of the ditch, Wall Street soils itself yesterday and we're pretty much back where we started. But we did catch a genocidal mastermind this week, so count your blessings. Among the other blessings on the way in the next 20 minutes, whether just standing around in Beijing can give you asthma. A haiku for Fanny and Freddie. One of our listeners joins us with The Week in Parenting News, and we'll have the first batch of your Obama jokes. But first, let's start small. Let's talk global diplomacy. We've been seeing a lot more of it from our White House this week than we have become accustomed to. We suddenly seem to be relatively chummy with the axis of evil. Six-party talks with Iran, Condoleezza Rice met one-on-one with a counterpart from North Korea. The State Department is signaling it is open now to a chat with Syria. How much does all of this matter, and why is it happening now? Good questions for Joseph Ellis. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning presidential historian and a professor at Mount Holyoke College. Professor Ellis, welcome to The Week.
My pleasure.
So the cynic in me says this is all about legacy, about a war president who, near the end of his term, is hoping to be remembered for something else. What do you think?
You're correct to point out that presidents in their last year are often thinking legacy, and that's a pattern that, especially in the 20th century, has been a dominant pattern. But in this particular instance, I think that the diplomatic initiatives with Iran and with Syria, and to some extent with North Korea, probably aren't coming so much from Bush himself as from other members of his executive branch, especially Condoleezza Rice and Gates, the Secretary of Defense.
And they're somewhat less diplomatically go-it-alone than the people they replaced, right?
Well, I think that both of those people have been somewhat resistant to a neoconservative, unilateral approach to American policy. Their perspectives are being allowed to express themselves and ascend to policy action, which wouldn't have happened if Rumsfeld was still in charge in defense or if Cheney was exercising his influence over policy. I think that the neoconservative approach has been discredited, and I don't know whether Bush himself believes in this more multilateral approach or not, but he's allowing it to go forward, and Rice and Gates are pursuing it because nobody's stopping them.
We have seen this before, certainly with President Clinton, a fairly recent example, who sent his Secretary of State to meet with the North Koreans pretty much on the way out of office. Why do presidents turn to foreign affairs as their terms wind down?
The one area where the president has some measure of autonomy and can act without as many restrictions is in the foreign field. Domestic policy, any initiative that would require congressional support, is unlikely to be successful. You can take a diplomatic initiative because, as commander-in-chief, you have a good deal more leeway. And I think most efforts along those lines, historically by presidents, are rooted in an attempt to improve their own legacy. They're very obsessed with their historical reputation.
Well, have lame duck presidents ever really accomplished anything significant in these final months?
There are two presidents that did something that had historic significance. Washington's farewell address in 1796 essentially pointed towards a posture of isolation from European affairs, which became the dominant policy perspective for the next century. And Eisenhower, at the end of his presidency, called attention and warned about the so-called military-industrial complex. I think both of those were speeches. Presidents that try to make real policy differences at the end usually fail.
Well, it doesn't bode very well that we have to reach back to George Washington for an example. Do you have any hope for the Bush administration efforts right now?
The best way to look at it, the most optimistic, is to say that the initiatives towards Syria and towards Iran will mean that if, in fact, there is a Democratic administration that succeeds the Bush presidency. The transition to a more multilateral approach towards those Axis of Evil members will be less dramatic and it will be more seamless, and that's to the good.
And on that note, somewhat less cynical than where I started us off, which is a good thing, Joseph Ellis, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Joseph Ellis is a Pulitzer Prize-winning historian at Mount Holyoke. His latest book is American Creation: Triumphs and Tragedies at the Founding of the Republic. You are listening to The Week from In the Loop, and I am Jeff Horwich. All this lame duck diplomacy wasn't the only unusual diplomatic front this week. Democratic candidate Barack Obama has been trying to look presidential, shaking hands in Israel, Iraq, and for the very first time in Afghanistan. He was all the rage in Berlin, giving a speech so full of platitudes it is being compared to the lyrics for We Are the World. He's in Paris today, London tomorrow, before he flies back to where the actual voters are. John McCain, in the meantime, has been kind of stewing over the whole thing. His campaign tried to pull back the spotlight with a tactic straight out of fourth grade, an online video saying the media is in love with Barack Obama. Both campaigns are working up some stunningly frank new ads on the heels of Obama's world tour. Here is a sneak peek.
Hello, I am Barack Obama. I know that in the course of this campaign, there have been concerns about my limited experience in foreign policy. But I want to let you know that now I have been to Iraq, I have been to Afghanistan, I have met with our allies in Europe. So on the whole foreign policy thing, I figure we should be pretty much good to go. I got to meet with everybody. It's pretty much like I'm the president already. Heck, the Iraqi Prime Minister basically endorsed my campaign. I'm Barack Obama, and I approve this message because, let's face it, it's really just a matter of time.
Hello, my fellow Americans. Over here. I'm John McCain. In Arizona, you know, my friends, we've got a word for people like Barack Obama. Greenhorn. My friends, Barack Obama had never even been to Afghanistan until this week as part of some overblown campaign rally. And all the network anchors follow him over there. Give me a break. Listen, if you want someone who can put on a flashy show, my friends, maybe he's your man. But if you want real experience, well, I've got 71 years of experience on this earth. I've been to Iraq 8 times, my friends, 8 times. Cindy's still washing the sand out of my underwear. Anyway, I'm John McCain, and I approve this message because, you know what? I'm running too.
You gotta feel for John McCain. The campaign is hoping to draw some media eyeballs back when he meets today with the Dalai Lama. To which our producer Sandon Totten said,
at this point, the only person John McCain could meet with that would actually get some media attention is probably Barack Obama.
Ouch! Sandon will be back later in the show with some listener jokes actually pointed at Obama. Since we tangentially brought up the Dalai Lama there, let's stay on China for a moment. It came to light this week that the U.S. Olympic Committee is issuing air filter masks to American athletes for the upcoming Olympic Games. Athletes headed to Beijing are debating whether to wear the masks, especially where it might come off as kind of an insult, like the opening ceremonies. We were sniffing around for people to talk to, and right under our noses we found Professor Matt Simsek. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Matt's an environmental health researcher at the University of Minnesota, studying, in fact, air quality and water quality. And are you looking forward to the Olympics?
Absolutely. I love the Olympics. Actually, we have a former student that was in my air pollution class that's going to be rowing on the two-man team.
So you've got an interest in how healthy they are out there and how things proceed. Are these athletes overreacting, in your opinion? Just how bad can it be that you need to put on a mask when you're just sort of dropping into town for an event and leaving?
Well, it's certainly bad enough that the Chinese government several years ago brought in researchers to find out how bad the pollution was and where it's coming from. China recognizes that they have an air pollution problem. Everyone else going over there to perform recognizes there's an air pollution problem. It's a question of whether or not the mitigation techniques that they've employed will reduce the air pollution enough that they can perform at a top level.
How does the air that athletes can expect in Beijing compare to, say, an air quality advisory day here in the Twin Cities or elsewhere in the U.S.?
in the 20 years or so that I've been around Minnesota, I think we've only had a couple where they've actually said even healthy individuals should stay inside and not exercise outdoors. Pretty much that's a daily occurrence in areas like Beijing and China, Hong Kong, where some of the games are actually going to be played as well.
Physiologically, what are athletes worried about? What happens when you breathe that air?
Well, so with ozone, it's actually an oxidant, and so it can actually oxidize the lining of your lungs, and that can cause inflammation. Of course, inflammation in the lungs is very similar to asthma. Even if you didn't have ozone, if you just had particulate air pollution, whether you have an asthma attack or not, if it's affecting your lungs and causing inflammation, that can decrease your lung capacity, which can affect your performance.
So which sports do you expect are most affected by this this problem?
Certainly the longer distance events, the marathons, the long distance running, the long distance swimming, anything basically over 2 to 3 minutes, you're going to start to see effects if there is pollution.
So how far should athletes take this? How protective should they be given what the air is like over there? Opening ceremonies, I mean, that is the big example. It's this big symbolic moment. Do you want to be basically saying to the world, yeah, the air here is pretty bad?
Do I think the pollution is going to be bad enough at the opening ceremonies that they're going to require a mask to stay healthy? No. They're not going to be exerting themselves. They're not going to be breathing in a lot. They're just going to be marching around.
Is it an insult, do you think, for somebody to put on a mask during opening ceremony?
Certainly, if I were putting it on the Olympics, I would take it as an insult. I mean, think about someone coming into your house with nose plugs or something like that. If that's the statement they want to make, then that would be a powerful way to do it.
As somebody with an interest, it's fair to say, in cleaner air all around, are you hopeful that having this become politicized a little bit for China might actually lead to some long-term change in their clean air policies?
Yeah, it's interesting. I was just talking with someone the other day, and they mentioned, they said, why wouldn't China take this as an advantage to change their practices so they could have this kind of clean air all the time? And the counter argument always is that, well, you know, the United States became its economic power by polluting its environment. And so now China's basically just doing the same thing. The problem is they also have the advantage of hindsight in seeing how to do things cleaner. But generally, it's not until a country starts making a lot more money that people start to demand cleaner air.
Okay, Professor Matt Simsek from the University of Minnesota, thank you very much.
Thank you.
You are listening to The Week from In the Loop. We are online with lots of goodies like a blog, podcast, and whatnot at minnesotapublicradio.org/in-the-loop. You can also join up with our growing network of listeners we go to by email for ideas and submissions. We'd love for you to get on that list and help us build shows down the road. I'm Jeff Horwich, and let's see what else caught our eye this week. Speaking of the Olympics, the Iraqi team has been banned from this year's games. Apparently, their bureaucracy back home is just too much of a mess, and Olympic officials just said, the heck with it. Amazing they could get it together enough to compete 4 years ago, but since then, things have fallen apart. Call it Extreme Makeover Genocidal Maniac Edition. Radovan Karadzic is quite likely headed for a trial in The Hague for the massacre of Bosnian Muslims. Even 5 pounds of hair and a New Age persona can't hide you forever from the World Criminal Court. Interesting that he is found in plain sight only after a new government takes over in Serbia. The U.S. Geological Survey unveiled new work this week showing 1/5 of the world's recoverable oil and gas is inside the Arctic Circle. That's quite a bit more than we used to think we'd ever get from that region. The irony is that it's thanks to global warming, specifically the melting polar ice cap, that we are now able to get at this stuff. Also in northern news, I guess, scientists have apparently discovered what causes the northern lights, which is great, except I have read the incredibly dense New York Times article a couple of times now, and apparently it is destined to still remain a mystery to me. Somebody should check and see if the terrorists are targeting our construction cranes. Another crane fell and killed a man in Oklahoma. This is after recent crane collapses in Houston and New York City. Nothing cynical about this next item except how rare it seems. Congress and the president actually put aside some differences and compromised on a housing bailout bill. It includes relief for people stuck in difficult mortgages, and it bails out the country's two giant mortgage finance companies. On that note, we've got a lovely haiku sent in this week by listener Elizabeth Meehan from St. Paul. Let's have a listen.
And just who are they? Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Brangelina's twins?
A haiku from listener Elizabeth Meehan in St. Paul, as read by our editor, Kate. If you've got a poem on the week's news, send it our way at minnesotapublicradio.org/in-the-loop. Moving on now, you may have heard us call out on this show for people who follow a particular area of news especially closely, for whatever reason, to maybe come in and join us as correspondents for that area of news. One person we heard back from was Elizabeth Wickerin. And Elizabeth, thank you very much for coming on into the studio today.
Thanks a lot.
Now, the area of news that you follow particularly carefully, we're going to call it the Week in Parenting. And what's your personal interest in this topic?
Well, I am a parent of three children, actually, so definitely want to know what's going on in the world.
You just keep track of what headlines and studies and so forth are coming across the transom. I want to start with one you shared with us about the number of babies being born in this country. What's new there?
We're having another little tiny baby boom. I say tiny because the increase isn't especially sharp, but the total amount of babies actually is exceeding the height of the famous baby boom.
Yeah, 4,315,000 babies born in 2007. It's anybody's guess, really, but yours is as good as anyone's. What do you think is going on? Why are we having so many babies?
Well, I think part of it is because the baby boomlet, which would be the children of the baby boomers, are now entering reproductive age and starting to have their own children. And also, something that hasn't really happened before is people who have never previously had babies and are now in their late 30s and 40s are deciding, hey, you know, maybe I will go ahead and have a kid or two before I'm done.
Wow. Yeah, and I just had my first child not too long ago, so I guess I'm a part of it. And who can explain why, but apparently I'm not alone. So what direction do you want to take us next? What else caught your eye this week?
Well, there's another study that came out recently that said that one-third of U.S. parents have really unrealistic expectations when it comes to infant development.
Overly optimistic expectations, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Parents don't understand there are wide windows of when children should start walking, should start talking. And I think a lot of it is competitiveness, especially between moms. I'm sure dad's getting on it a little bit too, but you'll see a lot of that between moms.
And we all expect our baby Einsteins to be doing certain things and stacking blocks and cooing and trying to talk by a certain point. But what's your experience with three kids? Does it always happen the way you expect?
Absolutely not. They all do it in their own time, and there's pretty much nothing you can do to make it happen any faster or any slower.
And researchers, I think that was from the University of Rochester, right, are telling us at least now that we all need to just chill out a bit, that many of us expect too much from those little babies.
Absolutely.
Well, let's hit one more here. There was a study that came out this week, I think, from the University of Minnesota, if I recall, it was close to home, about boys and girls who eat dinner with their families. What was the deal there?
This particular study showed that girls who ate dinners with their families regularly were less likely to engage in drinking alcohol and doing drugs.
Not at the table, but later on, right?
In general, yes.
But what about the boys? You mentioned the girls.
Right. And this particular study actually showed that the effect only applied to girls and that boys were not affected at all by family dinners when it came to drugs and alcohol. Other studies have shown benefits for boys from family dinners, you know, in other areas. But even those studies showed that girls got far more benefit than boys did from the family dinners.
Any evidence that eating dinner every night with your family could make you more likely to do drugs and drink alcohol?
I suppose it depends on your family.
Maybe that's once you get older. All right, Elizabeth Wickerin, thank you very much. The Week in Parenting. We're glad to have you with us.
Thank you very much.
If you've got a news niche that you follow especially closely and you might like to join us on the show like Elizabeth to give us a briefing, let us know. Go to minnesotapublicradio.org and look for In the Loop. I'm Jeff Horwich, and last week on the show, we had a different kind of a call for listener participation. My producer, Sandon Totten, and I were discussing how comedians and cartoonists are having some deal of trouble making fun of Barack Obama. And Sandon's back with us now. Sandon, why has it been so difficult?
Well, Barack Obama is a hard target because he doesn't have any obvious flaws, no weird habits, you know. His race is a touchy subject. It just makes him kind of untouchable, you know.
And he hasn't had any major goofs so far.
Not yet.
Of the level that late-night comedians will just, like, run with that for weeks and weeks.
They're waiting for it. When this guy slips up, he's going to fall hard.
So, in the meantime, we asked for listeners to help us out, and we got jokes from all over the country. Sandon, why don't you start us out?
Okay, let's see. We got this joke here from Craig Kenworthy from Bozeman, Montana, and he sent us this take on the classic light bulb joke.
How many Barack Obamas does it take to change a light bulb? Only one, but it has to be changed the light bulb can believe in.
Okay. So that's kind of a variation on the joke that you told last week, but I like the phrasing of it. It's good.
Yeah, I think people should make fun of his slogans a bit more. They can be ridiculous out of context.
All right, what's next?
We got this one here. What do Barack Obama and the Leaning Tower of Pisa have in common?
I don't know.
They're both shifting to the right. That was from Andy McGrath in Alliance, Ohio, and he also sent us this one.
How many Obama supporters does it take to read The New Yorker? Dude, that's not funny.
Ah, so actually making fun of the lack of the sense of humor from the Obama camp.
Yeah, yeah, it's a good one.
Yeah.
And speaking of The New Yorker, this one sort of is along similar lines. It comes from Katie Manthe in Minneapolis.
Why doesn't Barack Obama wear an American flag pin? Because he's a Muslim terrorist, duh.
You know, it's hard to define what is funny about that. It's definitely humor for our generation.
Yeah, I think the joke is that, you know, he's not. It's kind of a Colbert sort of make fun of what obviously is not true kind of thing.
Well, thank you, Katie, for that. Got any more?
Yeah, I want to give a special shout out to one guy, Paul Piccolel, who sent us a Barack Obama knock-knock joke, which, you know, I was hoping someone would do. So I'll lay it on you. Ready, Jeff?
Ready.
Knock-knock.
Who's there?
Barack.
Barack who?
If this place Barackin', don't bother knocking, just come on in. It was cute. It's worth a try.
Yes, that is, well, not necessarily needling you know, a particular policy position or a foible of his, just a play on words, but that makes me laugh.
Yeah, it was a good effort, and thanks to everybody who sent in Obama jokes. If you have more, you can keep sending them in to intheloop@minnesotapublicradio.org.
Yeah, and in fact, let's broaden this, make it bipartisan. We know there are lots of sort of old man jokes out there about John McCain. If you've got a joke about John McCain that is not about age, because of course that is the deep well that people
right.
have probed so far for John McCain, send that in to us as well. More John McCain jokes. And you can, again, email those to us at intheloop@minnesotapublicradio.org. Thanks, Sandon.
Yep.
The Week is produced by Sandon Totten and me. We are edited by Kate Smith. Our theme and most of our other music is by The Smarts. If you would like audio of this show delivered to you each and every week, you can subscribe to the podcast at minnesotapublicradio.org/intheloop. We also just launched a new In the Loop Facebook page, and we would love for you to be our friend. You can also track us on Twitter if you're into that. I'm Jeff Horwich. Enjoy the weekend, everybody, and we'll be back again next Friday with The Week from In the Loop.